Well, I hope that's the truth in your life today. I hope that everything is well in your soul. I think about this a lot because of the sheer number of people that we have on our prayer bulletin every week. We have a lot of folks that have physical issues. But we're never promised that we're not going to go through life without problems. And some of those problems are physical. Sometimes there are other problems. It could be family problems or financial problems. But sometimes they are just the fact that we either have an accident and get injured, or we get older and we begin to have problems. It's just a thing that happens to everybody, whether you're saved or lost. But for the Christian, for the people that name the name of the Lord, in the midst of physical problems, there can still be joy of the soul. This is only a temporary stop. One of these days, we're going to be in glory. And we're not going to have to worry about wondering if it's a wise thing to play softball at 64. We'll be able to do whatever the Lord wants us to do. I'm looking forward to that day, and so I hope that today it is well with your soul. Well, early this week, I was thinking about what message that I would preach, and you know, sometimes things just kind of morph. They just kind of change, and so sometimes I like to hang out in the book of Hebrews. And so I came across the verse, and it just kind of captivated me. I like to think that the Lord was the one that brought this to my mind. And as I began to develop this message, I thought, well, if I develop this, I can take this one little verse in the New Testament, but then we'll have to go back to the Old Testament to see some things. And I don't really have a problem doing that. I believe that the Old Testament is just as much the Word of God as the New Testament. I believe that the whole Bible is the inspired Word of God. And so I want you to look with me at verse number 32 of chapter 11. Verse 32. Now, we're not going to use all of the verse, but I want us to just kind of look at the first two-thirds of it. And what shall I say more? Now, what has he been doing? For the first 31 verses, he has been talking about the people that had lived their lives by faith. He had talked about Abraham, and he talked about Moses, and he talked about Rahab, and talked about all of these various people that are in what we call the Christian Hall of Faith, all right? We could maybe even say faith fame, because they are listed here all collectively. And so he said, I mean, what more could I say? He said, for the time would fail me to tell of, and he begins to name people. And so he begins to think about their exploits, and he's thinking, you know, I've already written a pretty long letter here to these Jewish Christians. So what I need to do is I need to go ahead and I guess kind of bring this thing in for a landing. And so he doesn't expound on these people, which we're going to do in just a few minutes. But he says, for the time would fail me to tell of Gideon, of Barak, of Samson, and of Jephthah. Now, we're not going to look at David and Samuel today. I've spent several years talking about Samuel and David. But we are going to take the first four names that are listed. Hence, you have the initials G, B, S, and J. And I put out to the side, as you see on the slide, they're four losers. If the world were to look at these men, they would look at them and they would think they really have some problems. And they all do. But can I tell you that every person in this auditorium this morning, including the guy behind the pulpit, we all have problems? there are weaknesses that you have, and there's weaknesses that I have, and there's weaknesses to the person to your right, to your left. Every one of us could be thrown into that loser category. But God has different ideas for people. He can take weakness and make it strong. Is that not what he said when he chose the nation of Israel? He took the weakest of all of the nations and he said, I'm going to show myself mighty through your weakness. The Apostle Paul gives that same truism. He said, I am weak, but the Lord is strong. We are weak people, but our God is strong. And so what does that do? When God takes weakness and God takes people that the world looks upon as not being, you know, really worthy of a whole lot of major accolades, and God does something magnificent with them, God gets the glory. I like it whenever there are preachers that I have listened to over the years, and they talk about how frail they were. But then I begin to look and think, God has taken that weakness. God has taken that fragility, and he has made something great out of them. I think about an evangelist sometime, because he was one of the early evangelists that I would listen to. It was a man named Carl Hatch. Carl Hatch was a soul winner. When God saved him, God saved him from being a drunk. By his own testimony, he said the only sin that he had never committed was murder, and he intended to do that. He said, but God saved him, and God put him on the straight and narrow, called him to preach, and he won thousands of people to Christ in the ministry that God gave to him. He's been with the Lord for quite some time now, but I had the privilege of knowing his family a little bit. I graduated from high school with his daughter. And when I think of Carl Hatch, I think of somebody that was a loser that God made a winner. And you can think about people like that. You can think about people like Christmas Evans, who was the one-eyed Welsh preacher, and how that he was as godless and as wicked as a man can be. And when he met Christ, he was trying to share with his old buddies about Christ, and they beat him up, and he lost an eye because they beat him so bad, and he just became one of the greatest preachers that Wales ever had. And so the stories are just over and over, and Hebrews gives us some of those. And so today we're going to talk about Gideon. We're going to talk about Barak. We're going to talk about Samson. And we're going to talk about a man named Jephthah. And so I want you to go with me to the book of Judges, way back in the beginning of the Old Testament. And we're not going to go through every little thing. Each one of these men could have many, many messages preached about them. So what we're going to do is I'm going to try to hit the mountain peaks this morning. I want to try to be respectful of the time. I want to go through these, but I want you to understand that these men are special men because they have been listed in the Hall of Fame, the Hall of Faith, all right? Now, if you go to Judges chapter 6, we're going to be introduced to the first man. And when you come to this man, I want you to know that Gideon was a rickety man. Now you say, we haven't heard the word rickety in 20 years. Well, I'm trying to get them all to begin with the same letter so you can remember it easier, okay? Now, I don't always do that, but today I'm trying to do it. So, Gideon, the rickety man, the shaky man, the guy that was a little bit scared. You say, well, why in the world would he be scared? Well, the reason that he would be scared is because the enemy was around. You say, well, what was that a problem about? Well, let's just think about this. 7 straight years, and I don't know if that's the second bullet point there, but anyway, 7 years in a row, the Midianites, which were the enemies of the people of God, every time the crops came in, they would send groups of people over and they would take the crops that had been grown by the Israelites. 7 years in a row, this has happened. Not only do the Midianites come against them, but the Amalekites come against them. And then the Bible describes some people as the children of the east. Now that doesn't mean that they came all the way from China. It's just east of Israel, all right? Could be, you know, groups of people, possibly the Jordanians, okay? And so you've got these groups of people, and year after year after year, they just come and they just take. Imagine you have a little garden, and you try to grow you some peas, and you try to grow you some corn, and you try to grow a little bit of wheat. Why? Because you know that you've got to have something to eat in the dead of winter when you cannot grow anything. And you're thinking, boy, we got a good bountiful harvest. And then all of a sudden you got a group of 100 or 200 guys, and they just come in and they just take all of your crops. If you've got any livestock, they take those. And you're destitute. And so when we see him, he is hiding. He is in a wine press. But he's not squishing out grapes. He's threshing wheat. Now, why is he doing that? He's doing it because he's trying to hide from the Midianites. And so for 7 long years, you've got the people of God suffering. So I can just visualize this in my own mind, and you probably can as well. But can you imagine you have a wine vat, which is not very deep. It's usually hewn out of some stone, and you can see those in Israel. And they'll have a little trench, maybe an inch or so wide, that will be out of it, and it'll go down into a lower area. And that's where the juice, when they would stomp, the juice would go out. Well, there's no juice in this. It's dry. So he's down. He's getting crouched down as far as he can. And he's trying to crush this wheat up. And if you throw wheat up in the air, you're supposed to do it in the open so the wind can blow the chaff away. But he's scared if he gets on a threshing floor. If he gets on a big flat stone, they'll see him. So here he is, he's hiding in a not very deep trough, and he's throwing it up just a little bit at a time. And all he's trying to do is just eke out a meager existence. The Bible says, by Gideon's own words, by his own mouth, he says this in the Bible. He said, "I am the least in my father's house." And he said, "In my father's house is the least in all of our tribe." In other words, I'm a nobody. And that's why we find him being a rickety, scared, insecure type man. But as he is there in this wine press trying to get him a little bit of wheat together for some flour, the angel of the Lord steps in. Now, when you read the phrase, "the angel of the Lord," often that is a picture of what is called a theophany or a Christophany, if you want to use that word. It's an appearance of God in the Old Testament, or appearance of Christ in the Old Testament. And so you've got the angel of the Lord that appears to this rickety, frail, scared man. And so, what does he say? "Thou mighty man of valor." Gideon probably goes, "Is somebody behind me? That's not me." And he begins to tell Gideon what he's going to do. He's going to lead the people to a great victory. And he goes, "I don't know about that." And he goes, yeah, this is what you need to do. He said, "We want you to go over and we want you to tear down the statue, the image of Baal." Now, that was a pretty dangerous thing because people in his own family were Baal worshipers. That's why God brought these Midianites against them. When we began to give our allegiance to things outside of our allegiance to God, that's a dangerous place to be. And throughout the book of Judges, you find a pattern, a cycle that takes place. You have people that are blessed of God, and then they don't remember where the blessings come from, and an apathy comes in. And after the apathy, before long, you begin to look at other things and you begin to put your affection on other things. And it got so bad in these ancient times that they would begin to build idols. They would usually find a bunch of trees that were maybe up on a hillside somewhere, and they would make an altar to Baal. And so he says, Gideon, I want you to go and I want you to tear it down. And not only that, he said, but I want you to cut down the groves. Now, when we think of a grove, we think of a bunch of trees. But when it's used in our passage here, it has the idea of multiple images. So we want you to tear down the major image. Then we want you to tear all the little baby images down. And so when the people came the next day to see what had happened, they were upset. They wanted to kill somebody who tore down these images, who tore down our statue to Baal. And then finally somebody said, Gideon did it. Now the Bible says he went at night. He didn't want to have to face the people in the daytime, so he took 10 guys and they did it one night under cover of darkness. But then when the people began to come against him, his own family said, look, can Baal not take care of himself? And so all of a sudden, after the angel of the Lord tells him this stuff, he has a name change. His name is now Jerubbaal. You say, well, what does that name mean? It means a Baal fighter. That's exactly what it means. In other words, I'm willing to fight against Baal. And so you have this man that is scared. He's doing his best to not get killed. And now he is told to go fight. Fight against who? First of all, fight against the idols, the images. But then God says something else. He says, I want you to be the leader of an army. And what do? They begin to tell him how he's going to do it. What you're going to do is you're going to take this army and you're going to go against the Midianites. You're going to do this. And all of this is found in chapter 6, chapter 7, and chapter 8. And so he goes, I know that you saved my life and I didn't get killed because I cut down the groves. I know that. But Lord, I got to have a sign. So he puts out what's called the fleece. Have you ever done that? Lord, if you really want me to do this, I need to see something. Now, is it wrong to do fleeces? We ought to have trust in the Lord. But I'll be honest with you, there have been times when I'd say, Lord, if you do this, I'd really know that I'm hearing from you. And so what did Gideon say? He said, Lord, I tell you what, I want to put this little fleece, this little sheepskin out. And Lord, in the morning, if the fleece is wet and the ground is dry, then I'll know that you're going to be with me when I go to fight. Next day, he gets up, and all of a sudden that fleece is just jam-packed like a sponge with water. He wrings it out, and there's a bowl full of water that's in the fleece. Now, you and I would say, okay, we got it. We got our answer. Have you ever gotten an answer and go, well, Lord, I need it one more time? So he said, I tell you what, Lord, just to make sure that it wasn't, just something of nature, in the morning, let the fleece be completely dry, and the ground all around it, let it be wet with dew. The next morning, that's exactly what happens. There's no bowl of water that's full because it's completely dry. And so he gets his answer. And God begins to do some what we would call crazy things. He's got 22,000 men to begin with, and God begins to just get them away, get them away, get them away. And he's going against an army of the Midianites, and he's thinking, well, I got 22,000 men. But by the time God got finished whittling his soldiers down, he had 300. And he's thinking, Lord, what are you doing here? Well, I'm the God that did the fleece for you. So he said, this is what you do. You divide your 300 into groups of 100. And you give every man a torch and a pitcher. And what we're going to do is when the trumpet sounds, everybody's going to break those pitchers and the lights are going to be shown everywhere. And we're going to be screaming, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. That's where Dr. Rice got the old paper's name, the sword of the Lord, right? And so you've got that night, you've got thousands of Midianites that are hanging there. And in the middle of the night, the trumpets sound, the lights are shown as they break those pitchers. And the Midianites are so confused, they begin killing each other. And they killed each other and killed each other and killed each other. And God brought a great victory through a rickety man. Little old Gideon, the least in his father's house. But there's a second guy that I want you to think about. I want you to think about the man Barak. Barak. You find his story in Judges chapter 4 and 5. Now we're not doing this in the order in which it comes in Judges. We're doing these names in the order that they came through when we read it in Hebrews chapter 11. But we have Barak, and I call him a rootless man. He didn't have much foundation. He was not very deep. He was not very strong within himself. And as a matter of fact, he was such a discouraged type man that he needed the encouragement of a woman. Now, that's not to disparage you ladies by any stretch of the imagination, but every single one of these judges, at least especially the last three, there were women involved in their lives. Now, the woman that's involved in Barak's life is a woman named Deborah. And she is a wonderful, wonderful woman, and she has encouraged him to fight. And the Bible tells us in chapter 4, in verse number 4 and 5, that she was a prophetess. That means that God was giving her insight to what was going to happen. Now, they had been under the gun of the enemy for quite some time. And just as though Gideon had been under the gun for 7 years, so the people of God had been under the gun of Jabin, the king of the Canaanites. And so we've got Deborah, and what does it say about her? That she judged Israel at that time. Now, you just don't put any and everybody in a judgeship. People that usually are promoted, and I use that because I think that there are some horrible judges. But a judge is supposed to be someone that is impartial, someone that interprets the law, someone that has great discernment, and they do not legislate from the bench. In other words, they just make good decisions based on the law of the land. And so you've got this lady, and she is judging Israel. She's making many of the spiritual decisions for those people. And she dwelt under the palm tree. And where was that palm tree? Evidently, it was an oasis that was well known between a place called Ramah and Bethel, or Bethel. And so this was in the area called Mount Ephraim. Well, when we look at her and we see that she was a judge, we see that she was a prophetess, don't forget that she was an encourager. Look at verse 6. And in verse 6 says, she sent and called for Barak. And what does she say to him? Hath not the Lord of Israel commanded, saying, go and draw toward Mount Tabor, and take with thee 10,000 men of the children of Naphtali and of the children of Zebulun? In other words, didn't God tell you to do this? And he is, I'm telling you, he is rootless. He needs encouragement. In verse number 8, what do we see? He said unto her, unto Deborah, if thou wilt go with me, then I will go. But if thou wilt not go with me, then I will not go. I read this, and the first thing I think about is, all of a sudden, you hear something at night, maybe walking around in your house. And these folks are not married, but if they were married, this is the way that it would go. Deborah, did you hear that? Get up and go see what's happening. He doesn't want to do it. She's the one that has the faith. She's the one that has been given the inside information from the Lord. And so she says, okay, I'll go with you. But I want you to know something. If you want me to go, there's going to be a problem. Now, why was he scared? I'll tell you the thing that he's going to have to pay in a second. Why was he scared? Because these people had iron chariots. The people of Israel, they had bronze. Not bronze chariots, but they were bronze workers. Can I tell you that in a fight, iron beats bronze all the time? It beats it all the time. And they've got all of these chariots. And so he says, I'll go if you go. In other words, you got the inside track with God. 20 years they've been under subjection. Just like during the time of Gideon, it'd been 7 years. So now 20 years, they've just been pushed down, pushed down, pushed down, pushed down. And finally, God raises up Barak. And so she says this, if I go, when the victory takes place, the glory is going to go to somebody besides you. He doesn't care. Now, most men, if they're the ones that's doing the fighting, they're wanting to get the glory. I mean, it does not matter what military general it is, what military officer. If they go into battle, they would like to lead the parade. But she says, you're going to win, but you're not going to lead the parade. That glory's going to go to somebody else. It's going to go to a woman. And you know, she's not even really talking about herself. What took place was this. God brought a torrential storm. And all of those iron chariots, they stuck in the mud. And the people of God were able to not fight the chariots, but fight the men in the chariots. And a great battle was won that day in the Valley of Jezreel. That's the same place where the Battle of Armageddon will take place. And so the glory will go to another. How did that happen? Well, Jabin, who was the king of the land, he had an officer. And the officer was the one that was in charge of the battle. He would have been similar to Joab in David's army. And so you have Sisera that is fighting against the people of God. Their chariots get stuck in mud. And then all of a sudden he begins to flee because he sees that we're going to lose this battle. And so he's trying to get out of Dodge. And they're chasing him. And he's tired. So he goes into a little village area. And there is a woman there named Jael. And what does she do? She says, hey, come in here. I'll let you rest. He thinks, great. I can hide. I can get my strength back. She lays him down and says, just be real still. Get quiet. And the next thing you know, fast asleep he goes. And then all of a sudden, she takes a tent peg. Peg about this long. It's what holds the tents tight. And she eases up to him, and he's laying there with his head down. And she gets that point about a half inch above his temple, and she's got a hammer in this hand. And she's probably had practice with this. She's probably put tent stakes in the ground before. And all of a sudden, with one mighty hit, she hits that stake and drives it right through his head. And I don't know if she kept doing it, but I know the first one did the job. He was nailed to the ground, and he died. You say, really? Yeah, really. The Bible says it. You know, I've known of some crazy things. I saw a picture of a deer one time that had been shot by an arrow through its neck and was still walking around in the woods. He wasn't walking around. He was secured to the ground. So we've got Barak. Gets a great victory, but the glory goes to Jael. Well, what is our third guy? Samson, the rash man. Go to chapter 13. Chapters 13, 14, 15, and 16 tell the story of Samson. Samson is one of the heroes. When we think about the Old Testament people that did great feats for God, Samson's one of them, but can I tell you, he was a rash man. He did not have much self-control. We'll see that in just a moment. But now he began good. Matter of fact, before he began, the Lord already knew what he was supposed to do. He goes to his father and he says, I'm going to give you a boy. And he's going to be mighty. Well, Manoah's wife was barren. And they were like, we can't have kids. And God says, yeah, you're going to have a boy. Start painting the nursery blue. Right? I mean, you're fixing to have a boy. But he's going to be special. And from the time he's born, not just at different times in his life, which some people do. The Apostle Paul did this. He had a time of a vow where he shaved his head and he fasted and did some other things. But from the time that this boy is born, he's to be a Nazarite. Not to be confused with the Nazarene. All right? Jesus was from the city of Nazareth and he was a Nazarene. All right? There's a church denomination today, the Church of the Nazarene. All right? But we're talking about a Nazarite. This was someone that was set apart. And what was he supposed to have happen? He was never supposed to cut his hair. Now, I've seen long hair. I've never had long, long hair, but I've seen long hair. All right? I saw a girl one time that her hair was so long, it was down halfway the back of her thighs. And I thought, boy, that's a lot of hair to wash every day. And so I've seen long hair. But can you imagine not having a haircut? Which is what it says. He's not supposed to cut his hair. He's not supposed to touch a dead animal or a dead body. He's not supposed to drink wine. And all of these things he's supposed to do from the time that he is a little guy. And so, he was a Nazarite from birth. But he began to have woman problems as soon as he really reached his young manhood. If you looked at chapter 14, he went down to a place called Timnath, and that's where the Philistines were. And all of a sudden he spied this gal that was a Philistine girl. And it was like, I like her. I want to marry her. And his parents were like, Find somebody from Israel. Nope, nope, I want that one. And so his woman problems began early. His parents got the girl and got her married. But then the Philistines went to her and said, look, we want you to find out the secret of his great strength. And so he began by saying, okay, I'll tell you. I'm one lady ahead. The Philistines went and said, he's given us a riddle. What I want you to do is I want you to find out the riddle. So he told his wife the riddle. She told the answer to the other guys, and he made this statement. If you hadn't have plowed my heifer, you wouldn't have known it. Ladies, you were called a heifer in the Bible. All right? So you've got his wife betrays him. He takes some foxes. He takes 150 pair, lights their tails on fire, and sends them out through the cornfields. And the Philistines are so ticked off, they killed his wife and her father. They burned him to death. Well, he's wroth. Well, the people of Israel, they say, hey, you're causing trouble. So they take him and they say, we're going to turn you over. And I'm thinking, he just evidently didn't want to cause a problem with the people in his own tribe. So he says, okay, tie me up. They take him to Gaza. They take him to one of these Philistine cities. There was five of them. And they take him to this one city. And they say, we're gonna make sure that we take care of him. And all of a sudden, he just snaps those ropes. He grabs the jawbone of a donkey and kills 1,000 of them. Then turns it up and God lets water come out. You have another story where he goes. And again, the woman problems, he goes to a harlot. And they say, oh, we know where he's gone to. We'll kill him in the morning when he comes out. He leaves at midnight, but he goes and he picks the gate and the post up that's holding the gate and takes it 2 miles to the top of a hill and just drops it off. And so he's got a Philistine wife that was a problem. He's got a harlot that was a problem. But his flesh was so weak and ours was just like it. I heard a story just the beginning of this week that just absolutely is horrible for the cause of Christ. I won't even tell you about it. Some of you can probably guess, but one of the quote unquote great Christian leaders in our country has had to resign because of sin. The flesh is weak, folks. It don't matter who you are. Don't matter if you're 18 or 80, the flesh is weak. And we need to be very, very careful about that. And his fall was great. You say, well, what was his fall? Another woman. He had a Philistine wife that was a problem. He had a harlot that was a problem. And now there's another woman named Delilah. If I were to say Samson, that would have been the name that you would have associated with it. That's because we always think negatively. All right? That's just human nature. We think negatively. If I were to say David, you'd probably say Bathsheba because we think negatively. So you've got Delilah that steps into his life. And, you know, he's just loving it. So what does he do? Day by day by day, she says, I need you to tell me what your strength is. And he would just make up something that was not true. But one day, evidently, she was so persuasive, she pressed him daily. He says, well, what it is, he said, it's my hair. If I didn't have my long hair, my strength would be gone. And it says when she saw that he told her the truth, when he went to sleep, she had a man come in, cut his hair very, very easily. And the next morning she says, the Philistines be upon you. He jumped up just as though he had done it before. But the problem was his strength was gone. And what did they do? They put his eyes out. They took some type of hot, probably stick that had a sharp point on it. and basically just held him down and jobbed that in both of his eyes. And he did not die, but he could not see the rest of his life, which was really not that long. But God gave him a comeback. Get this picture. A man that no one could subdue. A man who could take literally a lion and rip that lion's jaw in pieces with his bare hands. We're talking about a man, when the Spirit of God came upon him, did things that no other man has ever done, except in fables. We think of people like Hercules and all of that stuff. Samson was real. He wasn't something made up, you know, in Greek mythology. But you've got this man that had the strength to be able to do that. How strong would you have to be to kill 1,000 men and then take a break? That's amazing. But here he is, just grinding, grinding, grinding with some type of wheel, just like an animal or some type of slave would have to push. And here he is just going around in a circle, around in a circle, around in a circle, crushing this. And then finally somebody says, hey, we got a big party going on over at the Colosseum. Let's have some fun. Hey, you know that guy that bragged about the thousands that he killed? Let's go get him and mock him a little bit. But what they don't realize is, the Bible says, howbeit the hair of his head began to grow. They didn't keep his head shaved. They forgot about it. And God began to let his hair grow again. And all of a sudden, here he is. He's a blind man. And he knows he's going to be taken to the stadium or to the arena where all the Philistine people that are somebody, all the lords and the ladies are there, and they're going to be making fun of him. And he begins to pray and he says, dear God, would you give me my strength one more time? And they had a little boy that was leading him. And he said, put me between the two pillars where everybody can see me. Let me just be between those pillars. And this little boy takes him over and puts him between the two main pillars of this edifice. And the Spirit of God comes upon him as he puts one hand on this column and one hand on that column, and he begins to push. And before long, those columns tumble, and that building begins to tumble. And the next thing you know, the Bible says that he killed more in his death than he did in his life. God gave him a comeback. There's a fourth man, Jephthah. That's found in chapter 11 and part of chapter 12. And I got to hurry. I want to be done here in 3 or 4 minutes. When you come to Jephthah, what you find is you find that the Ammonites, another enemy of God, they have been ruling over God's people for 18 years. Now, Jephthah is a man that had to flee from his own people. I'll tell you why. If you read chapter 11, the first part of it, you'll be able to see this. Jephthah's father, he fooled around. He went to a harlot and he got her pregnant. Well, that was still his boy. Well, then his wife, she bore children, and those boys were only half brothers. And so what did they do? They said, when our father dies, you won't get anything. Matter of fact, we're going to run you off. And so they ran him off to a place called Tob. It was a wilderness. The people that he hung out with were unsavory, but evidently they were tough knockers. And the reason that I say that is because you've got the people of Gideon. And what do? They want to be able to defeat the Ammonites. But they don't have anybody that's tough enough. So you've got the elders, and they come to him at the beginning of chapter 11. And they say, tell you what we want you to do. We want you to come back and we want you to lead our fight. He's like, you guys ran me off. if I come back and do this, are you going to follow me? He's a rigid man, all right? I mean, it's my way or the highway when it comes to Jephthah. There's no give in him. And they said, God is our witness. We'll do that. And so we see that he comes back after fleeing to Tob. If you look at his life, one commentator described him as a wild, daring mountaineer man from Gilead. They said that he would be similar to an aggressive Elijah. And I'm thinking, isn't that an oxymoron? Elijah, he was already tough. But they're saying Jephthah was even more aggressive than Elijah. This guy liked to fight, and evidently, often. And so you've got Jephthah, and he comes back and takes over the army of Gilead. God gives them a victory after he makes a vow. Now, what is the vow? Dr. Scofield, in a Scofield Bible, calls it Jephthah's awful vow. It is a vow that he wished that he would have never made. And what was that vow? Dear God, if you will give me the victory over the Ammonites, when I come back into my town, the first thing that I see, I will offer that as a sacrifice to you. God gives him a great victory. Now remember, this is a rigid man. I've said what I'm going to do. This is what I will do. Now I also believe that he is a righteous man. But this vow is a hard vow. And he says, whatever I see first. When he gets back, he's at the beginning of the procession coming into town. And right away, he doesn't see a bullock. He doesn't see a sheep. He doesn't see a goat. The first thing that he sees is his daughter. His daughter. And what does he say? He said, I've opened my mouth unto the Lord. I can't go back. And so what does she say? She says, Dad, let me go to the mountains and let me mourn. And the girls in Jerusalem, what did they do? They would go every so often, every year, and they would bewail her virginity. And so the big question is this. Did he keep that vow? Can I tell you, I think he did. But can I tell you also this? I don't think that he killed her. Now, if you just read it at face value and not really think it through, you'd say, well, after she went and she mourned, then she was killed. But Jephthah was a righteous man. He would not violate the Torah. He would not violate the law of Moses, which forbade that. So how did that vow get fulfilled? Well, most commentators, myself included, we think this. We think that the most important thing in these ancient times for a girl in Israel was to what? Get married, become a mother. Right? Wasn't that what they said about Mary when she was blessed by having the Christ child? Wasn't she honored for being the one that was able to do that? And so I think that the way that the vow was, that it was probably fulfilled, was that she was never allowed to marry. And she went to the mountains and she bewailed that and she was sad about that, but then she reconciled herself to that and she died never giving birth, and so therefore she was dead once she passed away. And so Jephthah was a rigid man, and so, I mean, how often would he have probably thought, you know, I can't even let my daughter get married. I can't even let my daughter have a child. Why? Because I opened my mouth in a rash vow. I was rigid. And so he had an awful, awful vow. But he didn't just stop with hardness and rigidity in his own family. There were a group of men from the tribe of Ephraim. And after the victory over the Ammonites, they came to him and said, "Why didn't you let us go?" Now, why did the people of Ephraim, why did they want to go? Maybe they wanted to participate in the spoils. And there's a fascinating story in this. There is a word called Shibboleth. And when the people of Ephraim would try to slip in, they would have to say a password. And the people of Gilead, they were able to say, and I'm doing this in English, not Hebrew, they would say, Shibboleth. But the people of Ephraim couldn't say Shibboleth. They said Sibboleth. They couldn't pronounce the H. And every time one of them said Sibboleth instead of Shibboleth, they were executed. They were brothers. But those tribes were fighting against each other. And so we see that Jephthah, even though he loved God, he was a hard, hard man. And so, let me give you four takeaways this morning about these men. And at some point in the future, I may preach on every single judge. I may just do a series on every judge and just give a dedication to the whole judge, the whole sermon. I may do that. I don't know how soon, when, or whatever, but I may do that in the future because each one deserves it. But I want to give you four takeaways. First of all, Gideon, just do what God commands. Don't constantly fleece the Lord. All right? In other words, when the Lord gives you a command, just do it. Trust Him. You know, and let's not try to make wagers, you know. Lord, if you'll let me win the lottery, I'll tithe 20% on it. Lord, if you'll let me get a new Mercedes-Benz, I promise you that I'll bring people to church in it. God doesn't do stuff like that, all right? Just obey the commands of the Lord, which you find right here in the book. Not only that, believe all things are possible with God. Barak could have had the glory of the victory, but he didn't believe it until Deborah told him to. And it was her encouragement that got him going. But let me tell you something, once you get encouraged, stand on your own. Get a little strength on your own. Don't always have to have somebody pat you on the back. The Bible says that David encouraged himself in the Lord. And there are times when you're going to be lower than a snake's belly button and you're going to have to lift your own self up. And so, believe all things are possible with God. And then, if you fall, pick yourself up. Everybody's going to fall. Does not matter who you are. And when you fall, it may not be a public fall. It may be a private fall. But the Spirit of God is going to convict you of that. And what do? You pick yourself up. Samson fell on many occasions, usually because of a woman. But what did he do? Finally, at the end of his life, God allowed him to go out on a victory. And so, if you fall, pick yourself up. And then Jephthah. To me, he teaches that we ought to desire God above all earthly ties. Jephthah was willing to offer his own daughter. Jephthah was willing to go against his own brethren. Why? Because he wanted to try to honor the Lord and do right. His early life was not one that would be desired. He does not want to, he would not want to be, he would not want people to tell about his early life. Well, why is that? Well, because his mother was a harlot. A couple of years ago, we had a mission conference. And in that mission conference, there was a young man who had just gotten married. And one of the people at the conference told me about him, and I won't call his name. He's one of our missionaries to this day. And let me tell you why he's a missionary. We added him because of his story. This young man is probably in his mid-20s now. He's married. They've got one little baby. When he was just a little guy, when he was born, his mother was a prostitute. She lived across the street, or down the street, from a little Baptist church. And she was so sick of her life. She didn't have a husband. She didn't have really a boyfriend. She was just making a living and trying to keep her kid from starving. One day she walked into that Baptist church. And the people of that church loved her. And it wasn't but just a couple of weeks, and she repented of her sin and trusted Christ and got saved. Her little boy began to be in Sunday school. He went through the nursery. He went through the toddlers. He went through the early four and fives. He went through the little grade schools that they had, and she just kept being faithful. The church had helped her get a legitimate job. They helped them out whenever they needed help. And then he got older, and he was faithful in high school. Then they said, "We'll help you go to college," and they helped him go to college. He married this young lady, and they are missionaries today. And when I heard that story about his childhood, I thought, I've never heard this guy speak, but he's going to be one of the people we take on. If the church don't want to do it, me and Debbie will do it. Somebody's going to take this kid on and let him go to the mission field. For a man that's got a heart like that, that was a beautiful story to me. Jephthah had a beginning like that, and it probably made him hard. But you can't fault Jephthah for this. He wanted to obey the Lord. If he made a vow to the Lord, he wanted to keep it. He wanted to make sure, and even though he was rigid, he wanted to serve the Lord and honor the Lord. Well, let's stand together. I appreciate so much your attention today.